Faith Strong Today presents WikiGod with Mark Grollo. Hear new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe to the podcast at faithstrongtoday.com.
Well, hey friends, this is WikiGod, our stories shaping God in Toronto. And I'm your host, Mark Grollo, and this is the uncut Faith Strong Today edition of the show. So come on, you know it's a safe place. You can let it all out. You can be yourself. You can say, you know what, I don't know everything there is to think about God. That's not a sin. I'm not doing a bad thing by not knowing everything. And so that's why it's valuable to talk to each other and wiki other people's stories. And so here we listen to somebody else tell their thoughts about God. And that has implications for what might be possible for us. And so this week we're doing just that with Michael Messenger. Michael is the president and CEO of World Vision Canada. So, of course, in addition to sharing with us how he went from being a boy, little Michael, to president and CEO of World Vision Canada, Michael talks to me about the core values of Canada's largest relief agency. He talks about the distinction between a Christian organization. You know that that's something that I really don't like, the word Christian as an adjective describing something, especially an organization. But he talks about the difference between a Christian organization and being a partnership of Christians. And I love that. And how values centered around following Jesus really guide World Vision's mandate to alleviate poverty and suffering around the world. So he'll also talk about some of the difficult criticisms leveled at World Vision over the years, and how World Vision gains access to disaster and conflict-stricken areas all over the world, and how he's personally affected by witnessing some of the destruction he sees on such a massive scale. It's very personal. I'm grateful that he shared this. He talks about the core of his faith and how it propels him in his work. So, great conversation. Without further ado, I'm just going to get out of the way. You got to hear what Michael has to say. Getting right to it, here we go. Let's wiki some God right now with Michael Messenger. Michael Messenger, thanks so much for hanging out with us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be here, Mark.
President and CEO of World Vision Canada. But you weren't born that way. So I want to.
I came out with business cards ready to go.
So I kind of want to go back and talk about little Mike growing up in Moncton.
Sure.
I've been to Moncton. Charming little place, Riverview specifically. Where were you?
You know, I would say it's charming from the point of view of the people.
Yeah.
And the area around it is beautiful. And yeah. It was a wonderful place to grow up.
Okay, good. Yeah. And lots of bald eagles. I don't know if that was the case when you were...
You know, I don't remember the bald eagles
okay.
when I was a kid, but I was focused on other things.
Okay.
All right. I'll take your word
for it. Like justice and things like that. You had your nose to the ground, not...
That's right.
All right, good. We'll go with that.
Yeah.
See, you're already becoming kind of mythologized as we even before we start.
Yeah, so my parents met in at Moncton High School, actually, the same high school that I went to.
Oh, wow.
Graduated
so you're like
from,
a thoroughbred.
Yeah. I'm Monctonian through and through. And my grandfather was a Baptist pastor. I never met him, but that's what brought him to New Brunswick. And then my mom's dad was a VP of CN. And CN Rail was, of course, big in Moncton. And that was the main industry there. Closed when I was in high school, so it sent shockwaves through the... through the city, but...
Okay, so that was like a major employer.
It was.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So, you know, what was the scene growing up in Moncton? Big family, obviously a churchy family.
Yeah, I was the oldest of four kids.
Okay.
My dad was a doctor, a surgeon,
mm-hmm.
and my mother was a nurse, so she was at home most of the time with us.
Uh-huh.
She always worked just enough to keep her license going.
Yeah.
So, you know...
lots of medical talk at the dinner table?
A lot of medical talk. Interestingly, both of my brothers are doctors.
Oh, really?
And,
you're the disappointment.
Well, I became a lawyer and then working for a charity, so I kind of...
right.
Yeah, the disappointment, I guess.
You could, so, can you
I guess
relate?
The medical talk, you know, stuck for them.
Yeah, I was going to say, can you relate to the family when you go home for the holidays? Like, is it...
Yeah, my two brothers talk in code a little bit, but
Did it ever occur to you? Did you ever feel I have to pick up the family baton, or were you always a bit of the black sheep in that sense?
Well, you know, my father was the first in his in his family to go to medical school. So it wasn't like I had a long history of being a doctor or anything like that. I remember when I was in my third year of university flirting really briefly with the idea of medical school. But I think that that idea disappeared and I went back to my arts degree in economics as quickly
as
possible.
I feel like we should high five over the table because I had a lot of pressure. My friends were all getting into computer. So like computer science, computer programming. And I felt that pressure. And then I did like grade 13. And the courses that I needed to take, like finite, and I was just like, this is not going to work.
Yeah.
Nobody had told me that I had that artsy wiring. But, like, you were into law. So,
yeah, eventually.
Like, how do you get, you felt like more the arts and then into law. Is there, like, a relation there?
Yeah, even in undergrad, I loved grappling with the big ideas.
Okay.
And so I went to a liberal arts college in Boston that you know, had this core curriculum that exposed you all different things. And I think if I had zeroed in on science, I probably could have done it. But I just loved the you know, wrestling with the big ideas of the world. And that's what led me eventually first to World Vision. Then I left, went to law school, practiced law, and it came back.
Okay. You're really trying to wrap this interview up really quick. Yeah, just, you're like, already. You're like, and then, anything else?
Well, back to high school. But, you know, family life in Moncton, it was great. We went to, you know, regular churchgoers, a Christian family, long heritage both sides of Christian, you know, Bible-believing Christians.
Yeah, because I was going to ask, I found a quote. I dug up a quote where you kind of said, "My vocational journey started when I was young. My parents were amazing role models of putting Christian faith into action, and that became part of my DNA." I mean, so how did that journey start? Like, what were you seeing? Aside from them just being good parents, you talk about a vocational journey starting when you're young.
Yeah, I think it's amazing, and I think about this as a dad now, too, and my two kids. Mm. It's amazing what we learn and pick up from our parents, what's important to them. So I always saw my parents not just as churchgoers and trying to understand the fundamentals of faith, but living that faith out. So certainly my dad and my mom both chose caring professions where as doctor and nurse they'd help others, but
there's enough like TV dramas about medical people now where you like they're not all very nice.
I mean, that's right,
that really drives the shows like House and whatnot. It's not intrinsic to the role.
No, that's true, but at the end of the day they do want to cure a disease or help people. But my parents went beyond that. It was just the way that they valued family, that they connected with others. I can remember every Christmas, for example, my dad was on the board of the local nursing home. And so every year growing up, my brother and I would go wear our matching sweaters and go and help serve dinner on Christmas to the residents there.
So you were wearing ugly Christmas sweaters before it was cool.
Oh, you have no idea. My brother and I, probably the best was we had matching chocolate brown suits.
Nice.
And brown and yellow floppy bow ties.
Oh, yes.
I remember being so proud of that, though. I thought we looked pretty awesome.
So do you just have one brother?
I have two brothers and a sister, but my one brother's a year younger than I am, so he and I were together.
Dressed the same. And
exactly.
Had the same obligations in terms of serving. Okay.
Yeah. But they also were caring people, made charitable donations a part of their life. Yeah. And I also saw, you know, we went through a bit of a family tragedy, and that really shaped me as well.
Okay.
And so not only how my family responded, but how others responded there as well. My dad had a heart attack when he was 42.
Okay.
Right at the height of his career in Moncton. Yeah. We left Moncton because he had a heart attack. He had surgery and was infected with HIV.
Whoa.
So died of AIDS 9 years later.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we went through this whole crisis as a family, and it was really a chance to say, what are the things that are really most important?
Yeah.
How does our faith engage with us? What does it mean for us to live through this? How can we reach out to others? And I just saw some amazing examples of care to my parents and the way that they interacted and supported each other as well that have really stuck with me.
So how did moving, you said you moved from Moncton at that time?
Yeah, I stayed behind. My dad couldn't practice medicine anymore as a surgeon, so he took an administrative job in Ottawa.
Okay.
So I stayed behind to finish out high school the last half year or so.
I see.
And then went to join my parents in Ottawa, and that's what led us away from Moncton.
Okay. You lived in Ottawa for a while.
When I was in university.
That's my hometown. All right.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, cool.
Well, we had a house in Stittsville.
That's where I grew up.
There you go.
Crazy. It's happening right here. Breaking on the week. No one's ever heard of Stittsville, but that's okay.
Snowy Owl Trail, I think is where we
okay.
lived.
Yeah. I lived in Fringewood Village.
Okay, well, we were in Amberwood Village.
Oh, my gosh.
There we go.
I rode my bike. Okay, this is just going to turn into a little powwow.
We'll go offline and have a bit of a conversation.
But it was still when are we talking here? What years?
I graduated from high school in 1986.
Okay.
So 86 to 90.
Okay.
My parents were, 86 to 89.
Yeah.
My parents were in Ottawa.
Okay.
Eventually, my dad's health declined further, and he went back to where he had his surgery originally in Halifax.
Okay.
So they moved back to the East Coast in just before I graduated from university.
Okay. So I was like, could have been like a 10-year-old riding my bike around.
Right.
We could have like maybe even passed each other on the street in Stittsville.
Yeah,
amazing.
There you go. Small world.
Now we can rocket forward into you going to... You go to Boston. So why Boston?
Yeah, I went to Boston. I went to a small liberal arts college called Gordon College.
Yeah.
Two of my dad's sisters had gone there in the 50s. So people in Moncton at the time, their university options, if they wanted to have a Christian education, there was Atlantic Baptist University.
Okay.
But it only at that time went, it's now Crandall University.
Huh.
It only went 2 years. And so often we had this connection with Gordon College in Boston because the Maritimes in Boston were kind of geographically connected.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I had this family connection to this university, and I wanted to do something a little bit different.
Okay.
I was interested in a broad education.
Hmm.
The thought of 1,000 acres on the ocean sounded pretty good to me as well.
Is that
got
was
a scholarship
that on the
to
brochure?
Go down?
Like that's how they market?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think that's the first thing they lead with.
Yeah, right.
But I was also intrigued to look at my education through the framework of my Christian faith.
Yeah.
So Gordon is a Christian university.
Okay.
So I studied economics there and was actively involved. I was actually just down there on campus a couple of weeks ago.
Hmm.
I was now speaking, so it kind of comes full circle.
And the university still hits you up for donations, I'm sure, regularly, like my alma mater, Ottawa U. You still get the mail.
Yeah.
But you're actually like still involved. Speaking.
I get the mail too.
Yeah. Thanks for speaking with us. Now will you kick in some
That's
shekels?
Right. Yeah. But it was a great experience.
Yeah. And it sounds like, I don't know, we're doing a very kind of rough sketch, but it sounds like, did you have a pretty good church God experience? Did you have any periods of angst? Was there, were Christians kind of healthy people in your perspective? What was that like?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I mean, growing up, I had a very positive experience.
Okay.
So church was a positive element of our life. It was where our community was built around, active in youth group, and we go to church twice a Sunday.
Yeah.
And you know, this was just part of our life.
Yeah.
Interestingly, my dad, I always appreciated my father's perspective because he'd grown up in a very conservative, fundamentalist Baptist home. His dad was a pastor. And,
okay.
He in university kind of rejected that a little bit, and so he was a strong Christian, and we were part of a church, but he always had a little bit of cynicism built in. I think that was maybe a little bit healthy.
Okay,
so there was always a skeptical distance from some of the the subculture around church that I think was healthy.
Okay,
having said that, it wasn't all rosy. When I went away to university and really began to understand what it meant to make my faith my own.
Yeah.
It was kind of challenging, actually.
Okay.
And interestingly, I started going to an Episcopal church and really found that the liturgy was a place of connecting with me, which was about as different from my Baptist roots as possible.
Right.
In fact, I can remember going home and telling my grandmother, who was the widow of the Baptist pastor, she was appalled that I was even sipping alcohol in church
when I
took communion.
This sounds very close to Catholic, right? That's always the concern.
Yeah,
it sounds like Catholics.
Exactly right. That's right. So, but it was a challenge, and then of course, I saw both the best and the worst of the church in how it responded to my dad's illness.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because when that happens, was there a lot of support?
Yeah, I mean, you were 10 maybe, but in 1985, if you had a diagnosis of HIV or AIDS, there was stigma attached to that.
Okay, yeah.
It was you know, unbelievable at the time, and the church really hadn't yet come to grips with what that really meant.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, my dad went through a period of real depression that I observed, and they had a hard time reaching out and finding a church community to support them.
Like questions around moral integrity even?
It wasn't so much that, but broader questions like, you know, what's the answer to this? Well, have you prayed enough?
Okay.
You must have sin in your life. Is there some kind of other, you know, other element to it rather than what was really necessary, which was the church to just demonstrate love and care to my parents who were going through a terrible
situation. It's amazing
that
things like that can be said when there's like an actual like story in the Gospels that addresses that very thing.
Exactly.
Like the blind guy.
Yeah.
Was there sin in his life? Jesus is like, no, there's no sin in his life. But church, I don't know, there's something about church people that still, even though there's a story that addresses that directly,
yeah,
it's just funny how that still can happen. This idea, like, well,
so, you know, in the face of that kind of pastoral failure, it's really challenging. At the same time, though, I remember sitting down with another pastor during that time who just looked at, and I was just telling him about the story of our family, and it was a big kind of family secret as well for a long time.
Okay.
And him just looking at me and saying, you know what, that really sucks.
Yeah.
And really said nothing else.
Wow.
But what, and I've actually talked to him in recent years where I said, you have no idea how that was just incredibly affirming for a man of God, a spiritual person, to say, you know what, that's just a terrible situation.
Yeah.
He didn't jump to conclusions, didn't offer solutions, didn't try to over-spiritualize it or open up the Bible. He just sat and said, that's awful.
Mm. And how old were you then?
I was in first or second year university at that time.
And this was a different approach than you had been maybe subjected to.
Absolutely.
People, all of Jonah's friends or all of Job's friends kind of trying to.
It was just so freeing.
Yeah.
And even as I think about, when I engage in the biggest, some of the biggest challenges of the world, the physical needs of others, and you just get overwhelmed, sometimes all you can do is look across from people and say, this sucks.
Yeah.
This is terrible.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that we just have to find that connection and that empathy with people. And that was modeled as well. So that was, I would say that's the best of the church. And near the end of my dad's life, as they, my mom and dad wrote a book about their experience and others, and people rallied around them. And and really they found care and support at the end for sure.
Wow. That's amazing. Wow. So you, I mean, you went to the Boston and your father was recovering at that time.
Yeah, my dad died in 1994.
Okay.
So 20 years ago.
Okay.
2 days ago, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Huh. Wow.
So.
And you.
So he lived with HIV for about 9 years.
Yeah.
He's one of the first people in Canada to get the antiretroviral drugs. But, lived his whole time just having no idea what was next. So I think my parents really learned to figure out what it meant. And they modeled this for me as well. What it meant to live in the moment.
Okay. And were those, was he kind of his final days in Halifax?
In Halifax, yeah.
Okay. And so you finish your degree and you end up in Halifax again practicing law.
Eventually, but only after my dad died.
Okay.
So after my degree, I started working for World Vision right away in Toronto.
In
and then,
1990, right?
1990 is I graduated with a BA in economics.
Okay.
And came to World Vision, and that was the start of this journey.
So let's kind of move into the present where, like you said, putting your name forward for the role of president and CEO. What is involved in that? Were you the only nominee? No, I'm sure. Was there a huge field? What's the how did that process work? Because you had a lot of experience and you were COO for a while, right?
Yeah.
And that when you came back, was that the role?
I came back as VP of Public Affairs, kind of a senior level role that looked at that advocacy work that I had started back in the 90s, or part of it. I don't want to take the full credit for it, but that was some of the work. Added to that, communications and public relations and government relations. That was what I came in as.
Okay.
And then after 3.5 years of that, I started as Executive VP or Chief Operating Officer, the number two. And then became CEO on June 1st, 2015.
And I guess having a background in public relations in your role is helpful now. You're not kind of the bumbling president. You have some experience in what is required in terms of presenting.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Presenting your good side.
When I came back to World Vision in public affairs, originally the position had been posted as VP of Advocacy. And I thought, that's me. It's right in my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Then they added all this PR stuff on it. And I thought, I am totally not prepared for this.
Okay.
But it's been an amazing lesson, whether it's through crisis communication situations, or, negative or positive media, building up public awareness through events like the Haiti earthquake or the Asian tsunami or some of the other things. It's been an amazing lesson. Just remembering that at any time, you're not talking to insiders or to experts or even to the person across from you, but you're talking to the whole Canadian public.
Yeah.
So how the challenge is always, how do you take what's in our world a really complex message sometimes? Causes of poverty are complex.
Yeah.
How do you reduce it, making a simple message that's compelling without being simplistic?
Right.
And those lessons I've learned and have really helped me as I've formulated, whether I'm talking to our staff or to government or to other stakeholders or to donors, as I formulated how we can communicate
right.
the vision that we have for
the
children.
Or the media. I've heard you do like right. a 4.5 minute radio spot, and it must be the same, trying to achieve that clarity, that narrative, everything you're talking about in 4.5 minutes.
Yeah.
In media.
That and you want to do it in a way that's authentic and doesn't sound canned.
Yeah.
There's always key messages you want to communicate.
Yeah.
And I do a lot of work in advance of those things. And natural disasters are a little bit different. I mean, I was in Nepal after the earthquake, yeah. and I think I did 56 media interviews over the course of 2 days.
Wow.
In French and English. And, you know, there's not a lot of prepping you can do for that. It's sort of what you're seeing, what's next, that
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah.
But particularly on issues that are perhaps a bit more complicated. It takes time, and it's worth the effort to prepare and think about it. But at
yeah.
the end of the day, if you just keep coming back to the core of what it is you do, why we do it, that's really critical.
Yeah.
Somebody said to me one time in the face of communications crisis, and this has stuck with me as well, sometimes you can get, especially if you're being criticized for something, you can slip into I have to mode. So I have to defend the organization. Somebody suggested you change your mindset to I get to. So from I have to I get to tell the story.
Yeah.
I get to explain. You know, your posture changes. I get to, you know, I have to. You sit back, your arms crossed. I get to, you lean forward, and it's a dialogue right. and a conversation.
And it'll change how you finish that sentence.
Totally like, will.
Your tone yeah. and your even your content.
That's right. If we believe in what we do, you can be humble and open and authentic and hear even critical comments.
Yeah.
But if you believe in that and express that in an authentic way and just say, I've got a story to tell.
Yeah.
It's a true story, and it's one that I want to share.
Yeah.
That attitude and perspective is really helpful.
Yeah. We're going to get to criticism in a little bit. I'm sure World Vision faces some of it, and I've heard it myself.
And I get to tell the story.
But let's start with kind of World Vision. I didn't really know until I started researching this. Children come up a lot, but is World Vision focused primarily on children? I was getting that sense. I read that somewhere. And
yeah, if you, our vision statement is our vision for every child, life in all its fullness,
okay.
our prayer for every heart, the will to make it so. So right at the core of our vision is children.
Yeah.
The life in all its fullness that we talk about
yep.
Is, it echoes the words of Jesus in John 10:10, where I've come to give you life in all its fullness. Mm. That's what we want for children. And we are a Christian community-based, child-focused. That's kind of the
okay.
three elements of our work.
Okay.
But we really see children as really the future of a country, the future that and investing in kids is really at the core of who we are.
Mm. Okay. And that was from the founding. Can you give us a little bit of the
yeah.
how it got off the ground?
Yeah, World Vision was founded in 1990 in the aftermath of the Korean War. Founded
by
1950. Bob Pierce was an American missionary evangelist in South Korea, or
yeah.
in Korea during the Civil War. And
yeah.
in the aftermath of the war, he was there to win souls for Christ, but was confronted with the plight of one particular child and was challenged by the nun who was looking after this child when he asked what he could do.
Mm-hmm.
She said to him, you need to care for this child.
Hmm.
And so he began to send money every month to this little child whose name was White Jade.
Huh.
And that was the beginning of a revelation for him that God was calling him not only to save people's souls, but also to help reach out as neighbors to help meet physical needs.
Wow.
And so from those humble beginnings, child sponsorship was born and World Vision grew. Started in the U.S., came to Canada not long after. In fact, my dad, whose dad was a Baptist pastor, remembers Bob Pierce staying in his house.
Oh, really?
In the 50s, passing through.
Ah.
I remember him telling me that story.
Passing through for
passing
World
through
Vision?
New Brunswick,
like
raising...
Wow.
Exactly, doing tent meetings or whatever, raising funds and,
wow.
and awareness for World Vision.
Huh.
And so that's where it started, and now World Vision is one of the world's largest international relief and development and advocacy organizations.
Yeah.
Working about 90 countries or 98 countries around the world.
Right.
Here in Canada, we're one of Canada's largest charities, and we're privileged to have about 600,000 regular supporters.
Right.
So it's a wonderful privilege and an amazing journey, actually, to see how God's used World Vision to grow to an organization that people of all backgrounds can connect with and join us in this mission of fullness of life for kids.
Yeah. Can we talk a bit about the Christian component? You mentioned those three. How is it a Christian agency? What does that mean? Is that just good for donor talk, or how does it work? And I'm kind of on record as saying I have a hard time with the word Christian being thrown on as an adjective before whatever, a Christian bookstore or a Christian school. I mean, institutions can't follow Jesus very well.
No.
So what is it, aside from the roots, the beginnings, like you're talking about, Pierce starting this with Christian principles, how does that play out in the day-to-day, like the faith component? How does it play out practically in the organization, in the agency?
Yeah, first of all, I'm intrigued by the idea of an institution being Christian or not, and I think you're right. And what's interesting is that if you're to go back and look at our mission statement, mm-hmm. which, you know, I talked about the vision statement before, but our mission statement, it doesn't say that World Vision is a Christian institution. Mm. It says World Vision is an international partnership of Christians who together are committed to following
there
Jesus in sign, thought, word, and deed. You know, to reaching out to reaching out to others. I'm paraphrasing it, but that's the phrase that's there. At the end of the day, that's what we are.
Yeah.
We are followers of Jesus coming together from a variety of backgrounds, uniting around this common mission and inviting people to join us in our mission to help others, which we do without strings attached.
Okay.
To anyone, regardless of religion, culture, background, gender.
Oh, you're getting ahead of the question.
Oh, well, I think it's really core.
You must have
to
a history of public relations.
Yeah. No,
because you know, I think it sounds like you know the objections. Because I have had people say to me, because I'm a, maybe I should have said this off the top, I sponsor a child through World Vision. Does that get me a better interview here? I don't know.
I think that's great. What country?
India.
Okay.
Little,
I was just
little,
in India
little Amman.
Visiting.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sponsored child there.
Yeah. So that is one of the things is I've heard people say, no, World Vision only helps Christians and turns a blind eye to, and or asks for confessions of faith, almost inquisitor style. I don't know where this stuff comes from. There's other agencies that will help anybody and everybody, but World Vision is only for Christians. We can dispel that myth right here?
Absolutely we can. In fact, that's core to who we are. Huh. We want to give assistance to those in need with no strings attached.
Okay.
No matter who you are or where you are, World Vision wants to be there and partner with you. So we work in communities around the world. I actually just got an email from my sponsor child who's in Mauritania.
Hmm.
Mauritania's, I think they're, you know, maybe a handful of Christians in the whole country.
Hmm.
But we feel called to go and help meet the needs of kids there too.
Yeah.
Now, it comes from an expression, a core value for us, that we are Christian. That's our first of our six core values.
Yep.
I talked about our mission statement being this idea that we're a partnership of Christians responding to the call of Jesus to reach, you know, help others. Our vision statement comes, you know, it's anchored in the words of Jesus, offering life in all its fullness.
Yeah.
So I think it's fundamental to who we are.
Yep.
At the same time, we want to go deep in our faith and understand that, but it's also a broad reach to invite others to join us.
Right.
So Christian faith for me as an organization is that it motivates us. So it's the reason for why we do it. But we don't just stop there, because I think lots of other people can be motivated by good things.
Yeah.
Motivated that there's an affinity, there's an idea that we can connect with others who are like-minded, and together we can do more.
Right.
And I think there's a Christian element of that as well.
Yeah.
You know, even the idea of in the church, right, when two or three are gathered,
yeah,
God is with them,
yeah,
with us. And there's something powerful about connecting around a common cause.
Yeah.
I think as a Christian organization as well, interestingly, even to people who are not of the Christian faith, because our faith is critical to how we understand ourselves and our work and our life, we can engage in a holistic way. It's a bit of buzzword maybe, but you know, in a way that sees that poverty has a spiritual component.
Mm.
And so we can talk the language of faith with people.
Right.
Of course, at the end of the day, we also believe that Jesus offers transformation.
Yeah.
And we want to express that in how we live and how we interact and through our deeds and action. But we often talk about the fact we're this partnership of Christian, but we're Christians, and we're called to, we're almost on special assignment for God to meet the physical needs of kids.
Yeah.
And that's our part of expressing the fullness of the kingdom that is so exciting.
World Vision is also, and I've come to know this through kind of my church planting and my project, World Vision also has this other kind of robust church development arm, or what would you call that? You as president, you must know. This is not news to you, I hope. but I was surprised, because obviously we know about child sponsorship and international aid and things, but all of a sudden there's amazing workshops being held for pastors, and like almost as a resource for church staff and church planters. And Feuder came in and did neighborhood mapping stuff, and it's great for somebody like me to be taking advantage of what World Vision has to offer. How does that figure in under the same roof?
Well, there's an example where our Christian faith compels us to look for other Christians who want to engage in this kind of work, and our church relations engagement is one way that we do that. So we want to come alongside and help equip the local church to meet the needs in their own community.
Yeah.
Certainly we'll offer opportunities for the church to partner with us. And we've got, you know, large church partners who sponsor a bunch of kids or involved in various initiatives or even advocacy and justice initiatives and across the range of denominations who are partnering with us. So that's one way of giving back. You know, we've long ago, I like to think anyway, our goal is that we've moved away from seeing churches or other groups as, you know, just a big ATM.
Okay.
That, you know, please come in, let us do a fundraising Sunday and ask for money.
Yeah.
But no, that's not what real partnership is. And that's something, and certainly for me as president at World Vision, when we think about engaging, we have to recognize that we have a ministry to our donors as well as to the people that we serve in the developing world who are struggling with poverty.
Yeah.
There's a chance of transformation on both sides. But transformation doesn't happen if you're not equal partners in a relationship. And so where we can give back, we do. Similarly, the work that we do in Canada, helping fight domestic poverty, we've taken the view that we want to come alongside existing organizations. You mentioned Youth Unlimited, Scott Moore. He's one of the Youth Unlimited is a partner in one area where we've been working with them both through capacity building, sharing some of the lessons of development that we've learned internationally with local Canadian partners.
Okay.
So coming alongside, pouring into them, because together we're bigger than us. It's not about the World Vision brand.
Yeah.
It's about coming alongside. Now, at the end of the day, I also want to raise resources for World Vision's work. If that helps build a partnership and you know, builds trust and confidence so that we can partner together on a resource side, that's fantastic. But it's all part and parcel of our understanding of ministry.
Well, when World Vision puts their name on something like, you know, a neighborhood mapping shop for pastors, I mean, it communicates that World Vision cares about this stuff. And that's effective, I think.
Yeah. Well, we know that there's poverty here in Canada. One of the questions I'm asked all the time, or criticisms even, is, you know, why don't you do something in your own backyard?
Right.
Now, we as an organization really do feel that our calling is, for the majority, is the needs of the world's most vulnerable people. And for the most part, they are in the developing world.
Yeah.
Some of the world's most fragile places.
Yeah.
But we know that there's poverty here in Canada. So where we can come alongside of people who are doing great work. An example is even working with partners around the response to the Syrian refugee crisis.
Yeah.
So World Vision is working, I have huge programs in Syria and in the countries around there working with Syrian refugees.
Yeah.
But we're also coming alongside and raising funds and supporting partners here in Canada who are working with Syrian refugees. And right. I think that has to be part of a broad response.
Is there anything in terms of, I mean, we get the sense with the change of government, maybe there's going to be a lot more things happening with Indigenous children. Is that something that World Vision, is that on the World Vision map anywhere? I heard a stat the other day, and I'm probably fudging it, but Canada is seventh in the world in terms of economic index for globally for kind of standard of living. But when you just focus on Canada's Indigenous people, it's like 67th or something. There's a huge gap. Does World Vision address that domestically, or is that,
you know, it's when you hear stats like that and you see the situation of children in communities, Indigenous communities, I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's hard to imagine. It's the same country that you know that you know I live in my suburban life.
Yeah.
The way that World Vision has approached it, because our focus has been on child poverty and our focus in Canada has been coming alongside organizations that are working in urban centers, most of our work with Aboriginal communities happens through that context. Having said that, we are, you know, having conversations to say, what does it mean for us as we engage in our next strategy process to either support, whether it's financially or capacity or just, you know, working in common cause with organizations who are drawing attention to justice issues for Indigenous communities. It's an area of growth and opportunity for us.
Yeah.
At the very least, I may point to other organizations that are doing fantastic work to say, look, if that's a cause that is really critical to you, World Vision may not have the right response, but here are some great organizations that are doing this work in Canada.
That's good. We're talking a lot about finances. It's funny, as I started my research on you, I typed, you know, typical, go to Google, Michael Messenger, and when I got to like the last R, the first suggested search, apparently one that people look up, is Michael Messenger salary. And I was really shocked by that. I did not expect that to come up after your name. I don't know how you feel about that, that when you Google your name, salary comes. Michael Messenger salary.
Well, you know, we want to be transparent at World Vision.
And that was surprised me because I clicked through and it was very transparent. Yeah,
do you want to know what I make, what I drive? It's all posted right on the website. Yeah.
So I admired the transparency, but what do you think it is that causes so many people to check that out? Is that a deal breaker for some people? Is that a conversation you have to have when you talk about donors and partners? And
yeah, you know, it is a deal breaker for some people. Or let me just say that it's a concern for people.
Yeah.
And I think that as an organization that is about getting as many resources as possible to people in need, I think it's absolutely right that people should look and say, ensure that nobody's profiting off their needs. At the same time, it's actually a real challenge because I want to get the very best people in the business who are coming, even at some sacrifice, to come and work for us at World Vision.
And that is where it can verge on the absurd. As you're walking down the street, there's people with smocks and binders, and they say, well, we only take 4%. Well, we only take 3%, and the rest goes to the, well, we only 2-1. Like, how far down can you go where you're basically not taking care of the staff, building the infrastructure necessary? There has to be a ratio, right, that goes to the agency itself and the amount of money that goes to the people who need it. I guess you're always kind of playing with that kind of...
I don't think it's playing with it so much as wanting to make sure that we've got the right balance.
Yeah.
The need to invest in people, bringing the right people in, to invest in proper systems that support good stewardship, accountability, and management, while ensuring that as many dollars as possible go to our work to help people who are struggling with poverty.
Yeah.
And that's a challenge. And you know what? We haven't always got it right, but we do our best to be held accountable. I've got guidelines. I have a board of directors who has to approve our compensation schemes and our plans every year and asks us really tough questions around that. And nobody comes to World Vision to make money, even though I know that, you know, I have a healthy salary, and for some people it may be off-putting, but we try to do our best to balance that. And we explain the nature of how numbers are arrived at and all that kind of thing.
In bold, it said, you know, our president and CEO makes 25% less than the industry average. And I just thought that's very interesting that is very front and center and very important to World Vision to present that. And I guess it comes down to donors and how money is being stewarded.
Yeah, and you know, we want to do it right, Mark.
Yeah.
It's hard, and you know, it's a sensitive topic. I know my wife and I we do our best to give back as well. We put our money where our mouth is, I guess. We sponsor 12 kids ourselves, and you know, it's World Vision is certainly our charitable cause of choice.
Yeah.
And along with our local church. But no, we just want to be able to make sure that people come to us and understand the nature of our work. All of our financial statements are online, where the money goes, what's the percentage, where's the impact as well.
Yeah.
And that's just, I think it's just part and parcel about being as transparent and open as we can.
Mm. Can we talk about maybe opposition you face when you, quote, go into an area? I mean, obviously for disaster relief, it's probably different when there's an earthquake or something. What about areas of conflict? Does World Vision kind of have a pretty easy way into these regions, or does it take a lot of mollification through the kind of stuff you did in the early 90s? Is that the international relations piece? How does that work?
Yeah, it really depends on the context for where you go. So, for example, I just came back from South Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
I was there about a month ago. South Sudan is the world's newest country, probably likely to be the world's most fragile as well. So already suffering from 50 years of civil war before it had a peace agreement that started, that founded South Sudan. They began to get on a bit of a development journey, starting from really nothing, and then dissolved into conflict again. So I was there and I witnessed, you know, refugees and terrible situation. This is a place where World Vision's typical development work simply can't be done because it's just not stable enough. The state is too fragile. There's too much going on.
Yep.
So in those situations, sometimes it's easy because if you're there to, you know, we're part of an aid infrastructure, other organizations that are helping to meet the immediate needs of families. I met one woman named Martha who was raising 10 kids in a camp that of 15,000 displaced people in the UN compound in Juba in South Sudan.
Are the kids, the kids are not hers? The kids,
pardon me?
The kids are they
no,
hers?
They're hers. Okay. So her husband, who's a soldier, hadn't been seen since 2013.
Oh, wow.
She didn't know where he was, probably dead at this point. Mm. She was struggling to raise her kids, fleeing from ethnic violence, and raising her kids just on what organizations like World Vision was providing to her. So trying to address those needs. That, I mean, that those are easy situations in some ways.
Yeah.
But the context is really hard.
Yeah. But how do you get, like, the bureaucracy, the passports? That's a whole thing, that's a machine that happens behind the scenes to get World Vision there helping out?
World Vision is well enough known in the international community that we're trusted by the UN and other aid agencies. Mm. So we may be one of the organizations already, you know, on tap to be able to do that. We get we're on a list of organizations that the Canadian government will provide humanitarian funding for.
Okay.
But often in places, because of World Vision's large footprint where we're working, we may already be in the country. So that was an example in Nepal when I was there.
Right.
World Vision had been doing development work there for years. So we were already there. So when the earthquake hit, we were pre-positioned in a number of communities with supplies and certainly with relationships and connections so that we could hit the ground running.
Okay.
Same was in the Philippines after the typhoon when I was there a few years ago. You know, that's an advantage, I think, of an organization like ours with a broad reach where we can act quickly and we have the infrastructure in place to be able to respond where we can.
Right.
But there are challenging places. There are parts of the world where we can't get to or it's really difficult. Syria is a good example where we're trying to reach internally displaced people, but it's hard to meet their needs while bombs are falling.
Yeah.
And you want to... The heroes of the world for me are our World Vision staff working in those contexts who are putting their lives at risk every single day for the sake of following Jesus, for the sake of meeting the needs of mothers, families, children who are, you know, dealing with incredible insecurity, famine, disaster, but yet they go there again and again. At the same time, we owe a duty to our staff to ensure that they stay safe.
Yeah.
And it's a really difficult situation often for us to figure out how we can do that in a way that meets their needs but also values our people.
Right. And you describe you have staff all over the world, you're in certain countries, but you, particularly around you traveling to a place, like you named the Philippines, Nepal, and recently, so South Sudan most recently, that hadn't made my research, but just before that you went to Jordan and kind of traveled a refugee route typically to Serbia. What is it about these trips, you going there in person, what does that yield for you that a communique from the staff there wouldn't? What's the difference? Why do you find it that some places it's good for you to just go and see and I imagine live among it for a little while?
Yeah, I've had experiences with short-term trips and longer-term ones as well. For example, I went and lived in one of our sponsorship communities for a couple of months into Zimbabwe a few years ago, trying to understand and get that. I think what it is for me, where I'm leading an organization that is about that work at the grassroots level and the field level, to be able to have seen it and experience, I can speak with authenticity and conviction about it better than if I was just reading a report or sending communiques. Now, World Vision sends out a lot of communiques, a lot of communication that doesn't revolve around me. But particularly in a natural disaster or a humanitarian emergency, having somebody on the ground telling the story, raising awareness is really important. So I understand our context back here in Canada. I understand, I'm helping Canadians interpret what I'm seeing on the ground.
Yep.
The fact is that we've got great communicators in Nepal or the Philippines.
Yeah.
But it's often important for Canadians to hear a Canadian voice to interpret that. It gives legitimacy as well for when I come back and I'm talking to government officials or major donors or sponsors, communicating to the staff what I've seen.
Yeah.
To be able to say firsthand, this is the experience I've seen. Here are the stories I've met.
Yeah.
This is our world is not about statistics.
Hmm.
We could easily get overwhelmed by statistics or, you know, it can make us numb. It can make us tune out.
Yeah.
But when you hear a story like the story of Martha in South Sudan or the families that I met in the refugee camps in Jordan who fled Syria with their children on their back, nothing else, crossing, living in the wilderness for 8 weeks before they finally stumbled across the border.
Yeah.
these families have names, they've got stories, they have histories, and that's what we want to talk about. I want to make a connection, invite Canadians to make a connection person to person.
Well, I heard you talk about a man who you saw with his two children in plastic shopping bags.
Well, that was like that was thought, one, on the Serbian
border.
You thought
it was supplies, but you got closer, and
there, he was carrying his twins.
That's
it was probably the tweet that I sent out that was retweeted more times than any other. It was just a heartbreaking moment.
But it's suddenly something everyone can relate to.
That's like, a connection.
I have children. I can imagine being put in that.
There in one person is the embodiment of the desperation and the hope and the potential in these refugees who are leaving disaster behind. And all they're trying to do, and this was the story from again and again, all they're trying to do is find a place where they can, their children can be safe, where they can be educated, and where they can provide for their family.
Yeah. So traveling to these places and seeing this kind of devastation, whether it's person to person or a natural disaster, how do you remain hopeful? How does it not crush you? Because you're saying statistics can crush us, but also being exposed to one too many of those stories, as you're saying, can also be pretty devastating. Like when you go home in Oakville, close that garage door. Like how do you, oh my gosh, like that, you've got a lot of stories rattling around. You've seen a lot. How do you remain hopeful?
Yeah, a couple of things. One, I don't want to explain that away, because in fact, I do get overwhelmed by desperation. I have moments, and I had it in South Sudan where I look around and just say, how can this country get out of where it is? How can these families that I met possibly see that what they want for their children? And I get overwhelmed just like anybody else, I think. And there's a real, frankly, there's a spiritual and cognitive dissonance when I come home. And I can have this moment where I'm in the field and I'm thinking, you know, I'm talking to a family, a refugee family, wondering how they can make ends meet. And meanwhile, I'm thinking, boy, you know, my daughter's asked for a new laptop for Christmas, and I wonder where I can get the best deal. I mean, this is the dissonance that we have of our clashing life, right? And I don't want to ever lose the fact that there's dissonance, because I don't think there's any way, frankly, Mark, that I can try to wrap it up in a neat little bundle to say I've got it all figured out.
Well, Rick Tobias told me too, even in terms of what Yonge Street Mission does. I mean, even levels of poverty. You can look at somebody who's poor in Toronto, quote unquote, and say, you're not really poor because there's poorer people on the other side of the globe, but you're not, you can't, that's a dissonance that we have to have, and we have to be concerned about both. It's kind of like what you're saying, even in your personal life. You got to be concerned about Michael Messenger's life, but then also the scale of human need that you're exposed to as the president and CEO of an agency like this.
I do a lot of wrestling. You know, I think one of the lessons I've learned in my time at World Vision, even as I think about my own faith, which sometimes feels like it balances on a knife edge, to be honest. I mean, I have the hope that Jesus offers, and that's what I keep coming back to. But I also know that, unfortunately, in life, there's a whole lot more gray than there is black and white. And at those moments of dissonance, I just ask, my plea to God is not only to help meet the needs of the people that I'm seeing, but also to say, help me not lose this sense of tension, this sense that there is something that you hope for and yearn for, God, for the world and for these families, that is not lining up today. Help me live the values of this future kingdom that we see, that's expressed in the Bible, places like Isaiah 65 and other places. Help me live those values today, to be faithful, to say, how can I help bridge the gap? And rather than allowing these terrible feelings of despair or disaster shut me down, I just ask for more energy and help that fuel my passion to do what I can to be faithful to God's calling and help reach out. And that's how I try to figure it out.
But so you embrace it. You kind of steer into it instead of retreat from it.
That's been my approach. And it means that there are lots of unanswered questions for me sometimes. But I do come back at that. And it also forces me to come back and ask myself, what's the core of my faith? What do I really believe? And at the end of the day, it's that vision of what's out there. You know, this picture of what God dreams for the future. The creation he's created. We've made a mess of it in the meantime, but where is it that he wants us to go? That's something that he's holding out for us. And I want to live like that's the value, you know, that's today. So I live those values and try to do my part and try to invite others to come on that journey with me.
I'm just sitting here kind of slack-jawed because I've read enough kind of systematic theology books or theologians try to emphasize, I think, to comfortable Western people that this faith is ultimately an apocalyptic one, like that there's a hope on the horizon. I just think that if you're comfortable, you don't hold that as primary a lot of time because my life's pretty good. I got stuff. I got the thing. I got the comforts and the money. And it's only, I don't want to say people like you, quote unquote, but when there's a huge sense of need, the Christian hope of being apocalyptic, that Jesus always pointed to a hope, or the prophets always pointed to a hope, or the early Christians who said, you know, come quickly, Lord Jesus. It sounds like you're much closer to that than people who maybe haven't been exposed to that kind of thing.
Well, I think seeing the kind of destruction and despair that I've seen forces me there. I'm no theologian, so don't quiz me on systematic theology.
But the fact that if you're not, your life experience corroborates, even like the egghead Bible theologians say, like, this is an apocalyptic thing. And you're coming here and saying, the only thing that really keeps me going is the idea of the coming hope, that it's ultimately apocalyptic.
Well, and it's apocalyptic, I guess, in the sense that, you know, something significant's going to change.
Yeah.
It's the then.
Yeah.
But it's also the now. And so for me, it's that, I can't just live out there. I know there are some Christians who say, you know, why bother with environmental issues? God's just going to wipe it out and start us all fresh. I believe it's also not only a then, but a now.
Yeah.
So I need to live the values of that apocalyptic future, that vision that God has for what the future, with this family today, working with World Vision and responding and being the hands and feet of Jesus, coming alongside these families to help meet their needs. And it's a very present apocalypse, I suppose. Yeah. You know, so that's the connection for me, and that's really the only way I can figure it out. I probably have a whole lot more questions for you and around theology, around trying to make sense of this, but that's my simple way of just coming back to asking myself, God, what are you calling me to? Yeah. What does this look like? How can I hold out this hope to others? And how can I live my life in a way that's authentic to the calling that you've called me to?
Well, we've academized the word theology. So I would say we're all living theologians if we're thinking about how does God fit into this or that. I feel like my 3-year-old is a theologian right now. She's trying to figure out like where Jesus is.
Yeah.
Because we talk about him all the time and he's in the books, but like I haven't seen him yet. Like as a parent, you got to explain things. Yep. Like her lived experience is like, oh yeah, where is Jesus? That's a good question.
Well, and when you come back to the fundamentals, you know, leave aside Pauline, you know, questions or these kinds of things. Just come right back to the creation story where we are created in God's image. Mm. That means that every single person, male, female, no matter what their political persuasion, ethnic background, they're carrying the image of God. Mm. There's inherent dignity there.
Yeah.
There's a connection that I have with them. This is something that we share.
Yep.
And I want to do my part to nurture that dignity, to show, you know, express and help them experience the fullness of life that Jesus offers.
Yeah. This is a good place to wrap up, I think. It's been an hour of your time. Thanks so much. I just would want to ask, how can people, like right now the Syria thing is front and center. Who knows what it'll be 6 months, a year from now. Again, and that's not to trivialize current problems that are in the media, current issues that are really hot. But so how can people kind of best help in your experience? Like you say you're on the circuit, you raise support, but how can the average person help right now? Would it be choosing a cause or an issue like, okay, the Syrian refugees, or would it be something more general, more specific? What do you recommend to people?
I mean, I think it depends on, I guess, where we start to think about it. I think if you're a Christian and you're thinking about, you've been touched with the idea that we want to both love God and love our neighbors, and there's an expression of that, I would say look for ways of living that out. I would say the starting point is just simple acts of kindness and engagement in your own community. But if you're able and can, and you're interested in some of the world's most vulnerable people, the neighbors perhaps, that I'm putting in quotes, but those in need, the places that, as we model Jesus, who went to the margins, he went to those who are unloved, dispossessed, marginalized by society. Those are a lot of the places where organizations like World Vision are working. And so I would encourage people to say, if you're called to that, beyond your local church, beyond these acts of kindness and expressing God's love through what you do and how you do it, There's lots of opportunity to partner with organizations. Some people might want to build a relationship with a child through child sponsorship, for example, which helps support long-term community development, sustainable solutions. It helps people understand the big issues through the eyes of a child.
Yeah.
That's one way to do it. Other people are more interested in giving to specific sectors or causes. So maybe clean water is important, or economic development, or healthcare. There are ways of giving like that. Or just partnering. You know, some of the very best gifts that we have are those who say, please, who market most in need. You know, use where most needed.
Right, okay.
That's for me, the very best gift, because then that enables us to be as responsive as we can be to the needs, even those that we may not be able to plan ahead, but to be able to respond as we see a child or a family or a community in need, to be able to reach out and help them in Jesus' name.
Okay, so that was the what. The how would be just go to the website, and you're saying you will find kind of these different causes, these projects.
Absolutely. Worldvision.ca is the best way to do it. You know, we're at the Christmas season now, but at any time of the year, there's our gift catalog if people are interested in single gifts. Child sponsorship is there as well.
Yeah.
Also follow us. You know, you can follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at MJ Messenger.
And then I was just going to say, people can follow you, but there is a disclaimer. That something I tweet here might not be the...
I
haven't seen too much conflict.
No, I might change that because I actually tweet a lot about my experiences. Time. But, you know, when I try to tell the stories of places that I go, that's the place that I go. So at MJ Messenger or at World Vision Can.
So by the time this goes to air, you might have taken that down. And
I will have done. But that's a great place. And I actually, that's probably my favorite place of sharing snapshots of the kind of work that I do on a day-to-day basis.
Right.
And that shows that the things that we talk about on our website, which perhaps gets into brochure kind of language, is actually real.
Yeah.
The people that we're talking with are real people in need. World Vision's there making a difference alongside partnering with others who are committed to the same cause, our same vision for children.
And you'll be tweeting the polar dip? Are you doing that this year?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Now I'm doing.
I did it once and crossed it off my bucket list. I'm sorry. I have to say.
You know, Mark, I'm delighted that you're willing to do it again this year.
There we go.
Yeah. It's in fact, I'm doing the pre-dip for Breakfast Television this coming Monday.
There's a pre-dip to the main dip.
I do it twice a year. Twice a year.
It's so
raising
horrible.
Money for World Vision in Rwanda, clean water projects, and I can't tell you how encouraged I am that you've agreed to do it. With us again this year.
This is why you should never sit down with the president of a major.
Thank you so much. The children of Rwanda are grateful.
Oh, wow. You're really turning the screws. It was quite a sensation. You do it twice. So you thaw out and you do it again. It's run by Courage.
This year, the Courage Brothers started it 25 years ago. They've raised almost $1.5 million for World Vision.
Yeah.
I took them to Rwanda a few years ago to show them the benefit of their work.
Nice.
Amazing story of just deep commitment and fun partnership and a really... fun event.
Well, thank you. On behalf of all of us, thank you for doing it for us, Michael.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I know you're telling me this may air after the dip, but
yeah, we'll see.
It happens every year on January 1st.
Oh, I'm well aware. Thanks a lot, Michael, for your time today. Anything else? Was there anything you wanted to say? Anything that I don't want to end the conversation before you're ready.
You know what, Mark? This has been great. Thanks for the questions.
We overturned every rock.
Thanks for walking with me and realizing that, you know, a lot of these questions I don't have answers to. But it's just about being faithful and doing our part to reach out. Everything I do, I think I'm doing this to somebody who's created in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to try to be the hands and feet of Jesus to help meet their needs.
Yeah.
With that combination, amazing things can happen.
Yeah. I'll let you get the last word. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mark.
Oh, well, there you go. The full story, Michael Messenger. Check out, of course, worldvision.ca to see all that World Vision Canada does, or follow Michael Messenger on Twitter to see what he's up to these days. And now, make sure you subscribe to WikiGon on Faith Strong Today so you never miss an uncut episode of the show. And to connect with me, you can email me, mark@wikigodpod.com, or tweet me at Mark Rolo or at WikiGodPod on Twitter. I love engaging your thoughts and hearing your feedback about anything you're hearing here. And join us again right here on Faith Strong Today next week when we are Wikiing God with Jonathan Manifaux. He is a minister and a musician and a church planter with a community called The Village in Whitby. He's a BIC colleague of mine. You don't want to miss his story and what that community is about. So that's next week. Don't miss it. As for today, well, that's it. That's all. Thanks for wikiing.
Thanks for listening to WikiGod, presented by Faith Strong Today. Share this episode on social media and find more great programs at faithstrongtoday.com.